Today's podcast is sponsored by Zencastr. I use Zencastr to record the Tally Room podcast, and it's an invaluable tool. I record pretty much every episode of this show remotely, with my guests joining me from wherever they happen to be. Zencastr allows us to record with high-quality sound, even if the internet connection isn't the best. It records a high-quality version on the local desktop and then uploads it when the internet connection allows, meaning that the audio the listeners hear is usually better than what I can hear when I'm recording. It also allows for recording video. I use it to be able to view my guests, but you can also record video in 1080p. It's super easy to use Zencastr. I set up a link for a recording and send it to my guests, and we're getting started in minutes. Go to zencastr.com/pricing and use my code TALLYROOM, and you'll get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. I want you to have the same easy experience as I do for all my podcasting needs. It's time to share your story. Welcome to the Tally Room podcast. I'm Ben Rowey. We now have a new set of electoral boundaries for federal elections in three states, the most significant federal electoral redistribution in three decades. Today, we're going to explore what has been proposed, what it would mean for elections, and what comes next. My guest today is William Bowe from the Poll Bludger website. Hello, William.
Hello, Ben.
This redistribution process was kicked off by a change in the entitlement of seats per state. New South Wales and Victoria each lost one seat, while Western Australia gained one. The redistribution committees have proposed the abolition of Higgins and North Sydney and the creation of Bullwinkle in Perth. The proposed boundaries are also estimated to flip two marginal seats. Bennelong has moved from Labor to Liberal and Menzies from Liberal to Labor. Overall, this has had no impact on the number of Labor or Coalition seats, remaining steady at 77 and 58 seats respectively, while the number of crossbench seats has been cut from 16 to 15. William, do you think this redistribution has had any impact on the ability of either major party to win an election?
This is always the question that is the main focus of media coverage, and I think journalists try hard to look for answers that aren't necessarily there. You've made the point that it's perhaps more likely to mean one crossbench or fewer at the next election, but even that remains to be seen. The seat of North Sydney's been abolished. That pulls the rug from under Coley Tink's feet, but it also puts the Liberals in more danger of losing the neighbouring seat of Bradfield to an independent. Beyond that, I think that as far as the major party is concerned, everything is always very subtle. There are a lot of swings and roundabouts. I think that the Coalition are likely to win the new seat in Western Australia, notwithstanding that we've both calculated that it has a notional Labor margin. I think when Western Australia resets a little at the next election, that will be a naturally Conservative seat. Beyond that, you know, I could sort of identify a few seats that have made life harder for Labor, a few that have made life harder for Liberal. Perhaps, the seat of Menzies in Melbourne is the biggest change in terms of where the major party stands. I think we'll be discussing that Bennelong has become a notionally Liberal seat, but by the most fractional of margins. So far as the prospects for majority government or one side or the other winning the election, we're talking about a lot of swings and a lot of roundabouts.
Yeah, well, I did a couple of attempts with a pendulum to go like, what's the uniform swing for Labor to lose its majority, the uniform swing for the Libs to gain the majority, just with Labor seats and if you include all the crossbench 2CP seats. And in every case, it was a tiny reduction in the percentage the Liberals need to achieve those various goals. So I think largely that shakes out. And I think overall, like there are individual MPs who have been lucky or unlucky and individual areas and seats where I think you can talk about questions around, well, that's probably inflated because that area hasn't really been in a marginal seat before or whatever, that kind of thing. But overall, I think largely they shake out, right? Like where the playing field is about where it was before, just sort of on a micro level, there's some interesting things created. Let's kind of go through some interesting areas. And you mentioned Bradfield and North Sydney. Why don't we start there? We knew the North Sydney was going to be pretty badly affected, that the whole North Shore was well over half a seat short of quota, and that there would be a knock-on effect. And at a certain point, probably, unless they did some really creative redrawing, probably a seat would have to get cut. And they've made a – kind of feels like the committee has gone around and gone, this seat is the obvious one to cut, so we're going to cut it, and we're going to very much – when there's not going to be any doubt in our mind. North Sydney has been split three ways, like almost perfectly three ways down the middle and like divvied up to its neighbours. But then that has knock-ons elsewhere. I mean, probably the Teals to the east of North Sydney are probably at least in no worse position, although on paper, Zali Stegall's margin goes down. But yeah, Bradfield, North Sydney, interesting race. We've got two potential strong Teal candidates who could run there. We've got a prominent Liberal frontbencher, and there's even talk about a former state treasurer quitting state politics to run for the Liberal Party there as well.
What you just said, I think, is true of both the New South Wales and the Victorian redistributions. And I said, which seat are we going to abolish? Let's carve that one up between the three neighbouring electorates, and beyond that, try to upset the furniture as little as we possibly can. So North Sydney, I was not at all surprised by what they did there, because McKellar and Warringah on the coast there are kind of locked in place by big geographical barriers. McKellar had to gain voters. The only thing for it was for it to go south into Warringah. Warringah already had to gain voters. Now it has to gain more because it's lost some to McKellar. And what they have done, and what does not surprise me in the slightest, is what they did is that they've then pushed Warringah into North Sydney to take over the entire North Sydney local government area. And once you've done that, you've got McKellar and Warringah exactly where you need them to be. And you've got North Sydney not being North Sydney anymore because it doesn't have North Sydney in it. What surprised me, I think, a little more beyond that was the way they took care of the rest of North Sydney, which was to divide it between Bradfield and Bennelong. I perhaps thought that the existing boundary of Bennelong might be sort of hard to move. It too had a pretty strong geographical foundation. I think it conformed with local government boundaries, but nonetheless, they have, you know, just said, all right, North Sydney's going. Part of it's going to Warringah for, I think, inevitable reasons. And the next thing we have to do is give part of it to the other two neighbouring electorates. And then we have bump-on effects from there. And move away a little bit further from that, though, and the redistribution starts to get a lot more subtle.
It was just after midday, East Coast time, when the Gazette came out that said North Sydney had been abolished. But we also got a percentage of the voters in the state who'd been moved, but no other detail. And then there was probably about a half-hour window there before. Actually, the first time I saw a map was the AEC published a video and the redistribution hadn't gone up. And then that video featured a couple of maps. And I remember in that window saying the big question here, because you're right, all the rest of that was really obvious. What do you do up to the eastern side of North Sydney? And the question was, do they unify all of that with Bradfield? Because if they'd done that, Bradfield would have been quite dramatically changed. But instead, they've kept the identity of Bradfield largely intact and then chunked on a big chunk of Willoughby and lost a little bit at the other end. But like the core part of Bradfield survives and the core part of Bennelong survives. But there seems to be a bit of a philosophy here from the commission of minimal change, keeping seats the same where you can, minimizing changes to boundaries where you don't need to, minimizing the proportion of people who receive a letter in the mail saying you no longer live in the seat you thought you did. Maybe it also has flow-on effects about the administrative burden for the commission in terms of redrawing boundaries. But I think in a few places, it's produced a few odd things as we'll come along. They seem to have prioritized old boundaries being a key dividing line rather than kind of maybe drawing the lines afresh.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I've said, I think this is true in Victoria as well. You've sort of raised some interesting points about practical considerations that the AEC has to cope with when there is a new redistribution. It may be, though, that in being, I think this is generally true, when they do take the approach of upsetting the furniture as little as possible, it's perhaps bottling up problems for the future.
Although it did make me wonder, if they do expand the parliament, of course, they will have to redraw everywhere. And that does kind of give them a chance to wipe the slate clean. So who knows, if that happens in the next election or the election after, that could have that effect that all of this will become redundant, a historical curiosity. Now, Bennelong has not changed since 2010. And then even the boundaries right before that were relatively modest changes. You have to go back to the 1998 election when it last covered Hunters Hill to see a Bennelong that kind of spread into the lower North Shore. And so when I was doing my historical analysis, there was no difference between the estimate of what the result would have been on the last election's boundaries and what the actual results were, because the map had not changed at all. But this change, look, it definitely pulls it into an area that's better for the Liberal Party. But it was interesting that I think this would have been a much more catastrophic redrawing for the Labor Party in like 2010 or 2007. But maybe just because Kylie Tink has kind of softened the ground and there's no incumbent Liberal MP in North Sydney now, it's not as catastrophic a problem for the Labor Party as I think it might have been in the past.
As you say, the area it's taken is from North Sydney, and there, obviously, at the last election, we had the disturbance of Kylie Tink being in the frame. And maybe that of itself means that we've got a slightly distorted Labor versus Liberal set of data from that area. And if there wasn't a Teal, it would have been a, you know, more Liberal-leaning set of numbers. And we would be calculating a bigger Liberal Party margin there. We can sort of only speculate there. But as you say, the North Shore, you know, it's to the area that's electing Teals, it's an area that used to be absolute Liberal Party heartland and is now problematic. How permanent is that? You know, I think that's one of the big questions in Australian politics. But, you know, for the time being, we've got in Bennelong, both of us, I think, have calculated a 0.1, maybe 0.2% margin for the Liberal Party. So there's absolutely nothing in it. But as I've said, when you've got an independent in the equation, I think a certain number of people behave differently with how they order Labor and Liberal. You know, there was a bit of tactical voting going on among Labor supporters. I don't think that sort of necessarily matters. I think these are people who are putting Liberal pretty much last anyway. But it can have a sort of distorting effect with how people are numbering their ballot papers and create an unusual situation. And presumably there's not going to be a Teal candidate in Bennelong. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what the booth that will now be in Bennelong are doing at the next election. There could be a quite stark disparity in the swings that we're seeing when we're comparing areas that were a three-cornered contest, because Labor didn't lie down and die in North Sydney. They did in most of the other Teal electorates. So, yeah, Bennelong gets very complicated. It's a bad development for Labor. I don't think there's any question about that, even though we've only calculated that there's a quite small move, because it's a very marginal seat. It's enough to flip the seat in our notional sense of the term.
And it's still a lot of new voters for the sitting MP to get to know, right? That it weakens his personal vote and the benefit of incumbency.
Yeah, which is, I think, is particularly an issue, as I'm sure we'll come to for the Teals, because at least the Labor Party have, you know, a uniform brand that exists in every electorate. When you've got an independent having their seat fundamentally changed, they really do have to introduce, you know, a big swath of new voters to the very concept of voting for them.
If you were to imagine that this change happened in, say, 2016, you would be looking at Lane Cove and Hunters Hill as like virgin terrain where the Labor Party had not campaigned particularly hard and no one had. It was pretty safe. It had a sitting Liberal MP. I do think there's some reasons that, okay, maybe Kylie Tink's campaign made the Labor 2PP look better than it might have if it was the Labor versus Liberal contest. But on the other hand, it does mean it's not such a harsh jump for those voters. Like, they are in a seat that has been marginal at the last election. They are in a seat where the Liberal MP has already been knocked out. You know, these voters haven't been receiving newsletters from their local Liberal MP for the last 3 years. And, you know, there's a little bit of evidence on the ground. The Labor Party's done really well in Lane Cove Council, which is sort of a bit of a surprise, but they've done really well in the local council. And I think there's a bit of a, like, we don't know exactly how well they'll do, but this area has been changing and it's not just about the Teals. Some people have been like, well, Kylie Tink should run for Bennelong. I still think even as an incumbent MP, there's a big part of the Teal base that's Labor and Greens voters who vote for the Teals because they can win. And I think running in a seat where there's a sitting Labor MP and the Liberals are fighting hard is exactly the kind of place where the Teals get squeezed out. Like, I don't really see, they can put someone up if they want, but it seems like kind of a waste of a sitting MP to do that.
They're referring to the recent history in North Sydney. There was a little bit of talk that the Liberal Party might lose the seat in 2007. This sort of proved a bit of a damp squib. But all the talk back then was of doctors' wives, you know, the big issues being the time being the Iraq War and the Kyoto Protocol were driving, you know, what are now the teal seats in a, if only temporarily, leftward direction. We've seen that phenomenon solidify. We don't hear talk of doctors' wives specifically, but obviously this was the first rumblings of the phenomenon that played out there. And Joe Hockey was the member back there. So, you know, there was a bit of polling going around showing it was 50-50 in 2007. So this sort of talk was in the air. Like I said, the doctor's wives phenomenon was a bit of a fizzer at that time, but the phenomenon that was being identified has continued playing out.
It turned out to be more premature than wrong.
Yeah, and you know, we've got maybe not enough high-rise development department developments in these sorts of areas. I sort of heard one person sort of say that, you know, Kylie Tink should have advocated for more population density in her area and maybe her seat might have been saved. But the underlying issue here is that the whole issue about the need for more housing development for denser populations is the fundamental reason that all of these electorates were below quota and one of them needed to be abolished.
And whatever they say about capacity or ability, it is clear that you look at the map and you've got big swathes of red, particularly dark red, representing being under quota all across the eastern half of Sydney. And then you got a string of seats in the outer suburbs in the west that are over quota. And that's just the reality you're going to see. The last thing with Bradfield is Nicolette Bull, Kylie Tink. They're both strong candidates. I think some people are underestimating the value of actually being an incumbent as opposed to being a candidate who continues to campaign after losing. About three quarters of the seat is Bradfield still. So if Kylie Tink was to run, she would be reintroducing herself to about three quarters of the voters. So in one sense, I can see a case for saying we stick with the candidate we have. It is fascinating, though, because there is no pre-selection process. You know, there's a lot of things about the Teals, about Climate 200 that resemble a political party. And you could imagine maybe Climate 200 tapping them on the shoulder and saying, you've got to pick one or the other. But, you know, there is a group in Bradfield that decided to support their candidate. But as I've been saying to people when they've been bringing that up, she was chosen, and in the case of other parties' pre-selections too, they were chosen as a candidate for a seat that no longer exists. You know, like the Bradfield that Bull ran for last time is not the Bradfield that will be used in 2025.
Yeah, and I did wonder at the extent to which political parties were conducting pre-selections for seats that the Liberal Party in particular had a pretty fraught pre-selection, I think, for North Sydney. And I was looking askance at this at the time. And I should disclose here that I do work for Climate 200. That doesn't give me any insight into what's going to happen in terms of who ends up running in Bradfield, either or both of the two candidates who have been mentioned. But what has emerged in the news in recent days is that this isn't only the case on the Teal side. But for one reason or another, Bradfield really is up in the air. Nicolette Bull, who you mentioned, has been, as I understand it, on a sort of permanent campaign since she performed well in 2022. She didn't win, but she came within 4-5% of winning that seat. And that wasn't something that was expected. This was not one of the seats that everyone was focused on as being part of the Teal phenomenon. All of the seats that were being focused on were actually won. So I think, broadly speaking, Teal them outperformed expectations in that election, and Bradfield was in the ballpark of being a boil over. So, you know, she's been plugging away hard there ever since, apparently.
And it probably is impossible to say how much is that her, how much is it just there's these enormous Teal campaigns in the three neighbouring seats, and that's going to have a knock-on effect and flow on into her seat as well, you know, that it's sort of people, it does look like people kind of voted for them like they were a party, even if they weren't. The other thing that's interesting about Liberal pre-selections, we now have two different pairs of seats, Chisholm and Higgins and Bennelong and North Sydney, where one of them's been abolished. Both of them has a candidate pre-selected. In both cases, the seat that wasn't abolished is a much more multicultural seat. You know, like not that North Sydney or Higgins are monocultural by any means, but Chisholm and Bennelong, very multicultural, large Chinese populations. In both cases, the Liberal Party has chosen a candidate who's not white in Chisholm and Bennelong, and they've chosen someone else in the other seats. And in both cases, I think it's probably safe to say the candidate for the seat that was abolished has probably got better political connections in the Liberal Party, that those seats, North Sydney and Higgins, kind of represent more of the traditional Liberal heartland, and they're seen as like more important candidates in some ways. And so in both cases, it creates this dilemma. And I think some people have tried to argue, well, the candidate's the candidate, that's locked in. And I've been like, whatever they decide to do, that's nonsense. Like, a third of Chisholm is new. Like, the party needs to make, they need to make fresh decisions. Even if those decisions are, we're going to stick with the candidates we have, it seems kind of fair enough. Unlike the Josh Frydenberg trial balloon in Kooyong, which I think was ridiculous. But for the candidates who actually were fair and square pre-selected for a seat that doesn't exist anymore, I think it is fair enough for them to put their hand up and say, I'd like to run in this other seat that's nearby that's taken a big chunk of my territory.
Yeah, I mean, what I sort of like to say is that when you've got a redistribution, every seat's been abolished, you know, and it's just a question of which name's being decommissioned. So I was sort of saying that I was a little bit puzzled at the Liberal Party's determination to hold some of these pre-selections. But I think that that was to do with the fact that at the last election, they got into so much trouble for kicking pre-selections down the road. And in particular in New South Wales, you know, the party was tearing itself apart because Alex Hawke and his sort of centre-right faction were gumming up the works to preserve their own sitting members and make it that there couldn't be local party pre-selections, and the matter ended up getting decided in a sort of factional deal by the national organisation. And there was a backlash against that this time and a determination to lock candidates in early. And we sort of got the opposite problem, you know, that you've got candidates in early and now the boundaries are completely changed. And, you know, you've got an eruption of turf wars that's all the more pointed because you've got people who already thought that they were in place. And in particular, as you say, I hadn't sort of made the connection there between Chisholm and Bennelong. But there's a lot of sort of identity politics issues going on here. The fact, as you say, that they are multicultural seats. The fact that the Teal independent phenomenon was very largely a case of women successfully taking on men. So it's been felt very important for the Liberal Party to have women candidates this time, although not that important that they haven't got Tim Wilson going again in Goldstone.
And in fact, Chisholm and Bennelong both have male candidates of colour, and North Sydney and Higgins both have female candidates as well.
Yes, and, you know, that another layer of complication over the top of what, you know, would have been a complicated situation at the best of times.
To be fair to the Liberal Party, this redistribution has been taking a very long time. I did a blog post on this, like, there's just the whole process, this particular stage has taken months more than previous redistributions, and they have generally been getting longer, but this one is taking a remarkably long time. So I do think there's an element of that. There has been a lot more chatter about what happens if an election gets called before the redistribution is done, that I think is partly about the timing of us in the election cycle, but it is also just that the AEC has taken longer to finish this process than they did in the past, and kind of people just have to move on. So maybe someone in the Liberal Party would say, well, your criticisms, you know, this has proven to be a problem, but there's probably dozens of other seats which where we've managed to pre-select candidates and it's worked out fine. So maybe it was worth it, but they will have to clean it up. It's not simply a matter of going, the decision's made, your seat name's been abolished, so you're out. Like, they need to actively make a decision through their processes.
These problems seem to be ones for the Liberal Party this time. As we've sort of been saying, the redistributions have been fairly minimal, or as much as they can be. There was a lot of talk that there might be a seat abolished in the south of Sydney and a new one created on the rapidly growing fringes of Sydney. That would very likely have been a Labor seat that was abolished, and there would have been a very destabilising round of pre-selection brawling among the Labor members of that area. And that's a bullet Labor have dodged, I think, in this redistribution, that, you know, while there are always winners and losers from the various tweaks that are being made in the boundaries, fundamentally, there's no controversy as to, you know, who's contesting which seat for Labor at the next election.
And in fact, in that area that you're talking about, there are six Labor seats and five of them are ministers, including the Prime Minister. It sounds like there would be someone who's probably getting towards the end of their career who would make room for the Prime Minister if his seat had been abolished. But it still would have been messy with Plibersek, Burney, Albanese, Clare, Burke, and first-term MP Sally Situ all sitting within a six-seat kind of zone. And that brings us on, actually, to talking about what they did in the eastern parts of kind of central Sydney. You know, we often talk about these things like, well, so-and-so's seat is in the corner. And in the case of Kingsford Smith, I would have said Kingsford Smith is in the corner. And they jumped over the over the corner wall and added a little bit on the other side to Kingsford Smith. Kingsford Smith was surrounded by Botany Bay, the ocean, and the airport, but they've jumped over the airport and given it a little tendril of suburb, one suburb thick line along the coast of the kind of Rockdale area down to like Brighton, Les Sands and Monterey, which seems strange. I think it is strange. I think it's going to be hard to represent that area fairly. But it has this effect of meaning Wentworth doesn't have to push as far into the city that would have caused much more significant driving of Sydney into Grainler and Grainler into Watson than we already saw. And they've kind of taken that pressure off by having Kingsford Smith go this other way.
Yeah, and I didn't really notice this at the time because I was just sort of looking at a geospatial map, and the redrawn electorate looks okay here because I'm not conscious of Botany Bay being a body of water.
You'll get that back on me when we talk about Perth. I feel the same way about Perth.
There's also the Kingsford Smith Airport is separating that little spur that Kingsford Smith is being gained from the rest of the electorate. So it's an extremely awkward construction. And I sort of, without having thought it through, intimated that, oh, well, that's not going to hold. There's going to be objections galore during the process for that to happen. And it should be stressed that, you know, that this process will occur. There could yet be substantial tweaks to the proposals that we're seeing. But I'm sure that I hadn't thought this through, but, you know, you have identified the reason that they've done this awkward thing, that the alternative to doing this is doing other awkward things instead. Just sort of looking at it, though, I think maybe, you know, you could do other things with Kingsford Smith. You could add territory around Rosebery and Zetland in the south of Sydney and bump Sydney a bit more into Grainler. There are an infinite number of ways that you can do this jigsaw puzzle. The one they've chosen there is very odd, and I think they'll be hearing about it at least. Whether or not they're receptive to what they hear remains to be seen.
Yeah, well, if they did that instead, say you take those suburbs on the coast and you give them to Barton, which would make a great deal of sense. It would link to Barton very well. And then you gave them like the southeastern corner of the city of Sydney, which is in the federal seat of Sydney right now. That would then mean Sydney would take in more of Grainler and Grainler would move down into Barton. That would all make perfect sense. Grainler, I don't know if he still lives there, but the house that Anthony Albanese had lived in for a very long time had actually been moved into Barton, and now it's been moved back into Grainler. So, like, moving Grainler south would be entirely compatible with Albanese still representing the seat. It might make the Labor hold on Barton a bit weaker. It would be great for the Greens in the seat of Sydney, though, because that area you described taking out of Sydney is their worst part of Sydney, and they would effectively be combining some of their best bits of Grainler and Sydney in one seat. So that would be a really interesting one for the Greens. The reason why it would be hard to move Wentworth further into Sydney is you look at the map and they're already on the verge of, you know, the boundaries almost reach the Art Gallery, and then you got the Domain, and then you literally have the CBD. So you are at the point where Wentworth would be potentially taking in the Sydney CBD from the seat of Sydney. And I can see why they don't want to do that. But, you know, this is the problem with having seats named after geographical areas.
Well, I guess in terms of what this sort of means politically, I think that this is good news for Allegra Spender, what they've proposed. It's not surprising that it's happened. I don't think there was much that could be done for Wentworth other than add that sort of Potts Point Darlinghurst area. And, you know, this is a bad area for the Liberals. And in fact, there were reports in the media over the weekend that the Liberals think that, you know, they've got absolutely no chance in Wentworth now. There has long been a view that Sydney and Grainler are seats that, you know, we don't really have to pay much attention to at election time because Tanya Plibersek and Anthony Albanese have them locked down for Labor. But when they go, these are going to be huge targets for the Greens, potentially an independent as well. You know, at state level, Sydney has been in independent hands for, you know, as long as anyone can remember. So these seats being safe Labor seats is a contingent factor for the time being. I would imagine that the changes to Grainler are going to make Grainler tougher for the Greens than they would have been if it had remained more focused on the inner city than it had been. But I think that people who have been thinking this through more than I have realised that these sorts of changes were inevitable. You know, these seats, unless Grainler was abolished altogether, you know, these are seats that are going to have to be sort of pushed away in a sort of westward direction because they were all under quota.
Just to go through a couple of other places in New South Wales are interesting. I might touch briefly on the southwest of Sydney. Hughes did some weird things covering an area which is includes my old high school, where they've added a few suburbs in northern Campbelltown that have never been in Hughes before. And you pretty much have to jump through the middle of the Holsworthy Army base to get from one end of the seat to the other. That was a strange one. But one of the things that was fascinating was that Fowler was left entirely alone, Dai Li's seat. It sits largely, maybe there's a river on one side, but largely devoid of any physical boundaries. It could have been moved in any direction easily. Labor were very eager for that to happen, and it could have been the kind of thing where she would have had a lot of trouble getting re-elected. She could still lose, but that would have really hurt her. And they've pretty much protected her seat, even if that's forced them to do some weird things with seats like Hughes or McMahon around her.
Yeah, I sort of hadn't noticed that, but what you said Labor wanted to do is very telling. As an independent, you've got a particularly big problem if you have dramatic changes to your seat. You can't fall back on the loyal voters that your party has in the area that's been newly added to you. It really is terra nullius for you if you gain a new territory, and no surprise that Labor wanted to inflict that as much on Dai Li as they possibly could. I guess that's the other side of the coin for what I mentioned earlier, in that they haven't abolished any seat in the south of Sydney. This is sort of Labor heartland, lots of senior Labor ministers there. The rough that Labor have to take with the smooth there is that, you know, Fowler hasn't been disturbed. I think it's not an absolutely ideal redistribution for Labor, but on the whole, it could have been worse for them. The sort of confusion of Hughes you often get in seats that are on the urban fringe, they end up being sort of cobbled together leftovers, and sometimes they can be a bit illogical, and I think it's very difficult for a redistribution commission to avoid having a few seats that do straddle what ought to be obvious natural boundaries.
Speaking of urban fringe and what I think is a very logical boundary is Hume. Hume has been a total mess for a while now, where it's had two main centres and then a big population centre in between that it didn't cover, covered Goulburn and the outer southwest of the MacArthur region, but not most of the Southern Highlands. It's now lost the whole rural end of the seat, and it has become a southwestern Sydney electorate. Interestingly, I ran as the candidate for MacArthur in 2007 on almost exactly the same boundaries that Hume now covers, which is a consequence over time of slowly shifting seats. MacArthur now sits where Werriwa did, and Hume now sits where MacArthur did, almost perfectly, just because over the course of 18 years, those seats have slowly inched towards the city rather than them making more dramatic changes. And it's meant that those names have now referred to different areas. It does mean for Angus Taylor, on a margin basis, it doesn't make a huge difference, but the actual kinds of voters he represents have changed over a couple of redistributions quite dramatically. He's got a seat that's very much mortgage belt now. It's quite different to the rural areas he originally represented.
It hasn't made any difference at all to his margin, but it's made a big difference to the cultural identity of his seat. You know, I think back in the day, this was a seat where the National Party had a war in the water, at least. And I don't think that's the case anymore. There's a fair bit going on there. Even Monaro will now have Goulburn in it. So it's quite a different looking electorate and a little bit less strong for Labor. Not to the extent that I think we're going to see it going back to being a bellwether seat. I think that the growth of Queanbeyan has caused that seat to become increasingly solid for Labor. But that's where we are in the sort of southern end of New South Wales. No significant changes were made to Gilmore, which was something that was being closely watched. That's a super marginal seat that Labor held on by a couple of hundred votes. That could have gone in a different direction. But yeah, Hume has been changed very dramatically. And I guess that's the sort of proxy for the fact, you know, that they didn't create a new seat on the Sydney fringe. What they've done instead is draw Hume in to turn it into, as you say, an urban fringe mortgage belt seat.
Okay, why don't we go over to Perth now, where you are? I don't know Perth as well as I know Sydney, of course. Bullwinkle, yes, it is a very marginal Labor seat, and probably if there is a swing back to the Libs, it would have more traditionally been a Liberal seat if you look at the historical votes in that area. But it also has had the effect of making Hasluck a much safer seat for Labor. So even if there is a swing back, Hasluck, that you might have expected to flip back to the Liberals, probably is in safer Labor hands now.
Yeah, quite substantially, actually. And I think that a lot of the more superficial analysis will sort of say, oh, well, a Labor seat has been created here, so, you know, here's a free kick for Labor. But this was a function of the extraordinary result in Western Australia in 2022, that the territory that's now covered by Bullwinkle, you know, would have on 2022 voting have been won by Labor. I think, you know, 99 elections out of 100, that would not have been the case. And I expect that next time, I recall that the last time a new seat was created in Western Australia was Burt. Going into that election, I think Burt had a notional Liberal margin, but that absolutely got blown away at the election. This can be sort of misleading, where, you know, no one was campaigning last time. In certain parts of the electorate, they've never been marginal before. And the situation in areas that are now part of a new electorate gets completely transformed. Bullwinkle, for example, it's sort of cobbles together the suburbs on the eastern fringe of Perth with the Avon Valley region, which is very much beyond Perth and is a National Party voting area. It's an area where, you know, no one campaigned very hard in the past. Now there's going to be a lot more incentive to go in there for the Liberals and perhaps also the Nationals. The Nationals actually have got high hopes for the next election in Western Australia. They're going to even run candidates in seats in Perth, and certainly they're going to try very hard to win Bullwinkle. We'll see how that goes. They don't tend to have much success in lower house seats in Western Australia. Maybe things are different this time. My feeling is that, you know, Bullwinkle, with Western Australia reverting to type to an extent, we're not going to get 55-45 to Labor again, I don't think. So I imagine that that seat's going to go back to the coalition camp. How well the Nationals go remains to be seen. But knock-on effects from that are that Hazluck, which has in the past always been a really tight seat, has changed hands a number of times, was won very comfortably by Labor in the context of that extraordinary 2022 result. I think it could have been in danger of going back if the boundaries hadn't changed, but they have. So Labor have been strengthened in Hazluck, but it seems to me that the newly created seat is a coalition one.
The creation of Bullwinkle also had knock-on effects, shifting Perth and Cowan a little bit. And then further south, it seems to have cut Andrew Hastie's margin in Canning. But, you know, nothing like the big changes we've seen in Sydney.
Yeah, nothing too extraordinary. Again, I guess this is the third redistribution where they've, beyond the sort of impact zone of the creation or abolition of a seat, they've sort of tried to change things as little as possible. I don't think Andrew Hastie has too much to worry about. As I said, the 2022 result was extraordinary. He's technically marginal now, but I think he can expect a swing back in his favour. And I think that most of the other marginal seats, they're a little bit changed. I think I'd need to bring up the numbers to see sort of who the winners and losers are here. But, you know, fundamentally sort of seats like Swan and Cowan, they may have had their boundaries changed, but their fundamental character is as it was.
And then Melbourne, we have talked a little bit about inner city Melbourne. Most of the changes were towards the city, mostly in the eastern suburbs, but they had a little bit of a knock on onto the western side of the Yarra River. We know that Higgins has been abolished. Kooyong has taken a big chunk out of that, but also Chisholm. Worth mentioning with Chisholm that it has now had a couple of redistributions, all of which have made it more Liberal friendly, to the point now where when I estimate what the new boundaries would have looked like, you know, 15 years ago, Labor won that seat in 2013 at a low point, but that wouldn't have happened on the current boundaries. The seat is a lot more conservative than it used to be, but it's also moving into areas where the Liberal Party is not as strong as they used to be in those areas.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's moved into a big chunk of Higgins, and Higgins was the seat that Labor won for the first time ever last time. So, you know, clearly there is a long-term paradigm shift going on here. So maybe the changes to Chisholm aren't as bad as they look for Labor. As you say, it's been heading in a particular direction for a very long time. And that's true geographically and also electorally. But yeah, I think one way or another, it's going to be a flashpoint seat yet again.
And then on the northern side of the Yarra, the seat of Melbourne, Adam Bandt's electorate, has actually jumped the Yarra to take in areas around like South Yarra from a little bit from McNamara, a little bit from Higgins, weakened the Greens' hold on that seat. But these are areas that I think his brand will do quite well in, and he should be fine. And then at the other end, he's lost territory to Wills, which is really the big benefit for the Greens in this whole, across the nation, this whole redistribution.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the surprise here was that the Yarra was jumped, as you say. for both Melbourne and Kooyong. I think most people were wargaming this, were assuming that that boundary was sacrosanct, but they've had other ideas. Melbourne's going to be moving into that sort of South Yarra area, which, you know, I don't think anyone would have picked. And the knock-on effect for that is, as you say, that Wills has gained Carlton North, Fitzroy North, a very green area.
Although probably not quite as green in a properly competitive contest than it has been under Adam Bandt.
No doubt, you know, a certain amount of that is Adam Bandt's vote, but we're still talking areas that are green in the state parliament. And the geography of Wills isn't hard to understand. The southern end of it is, you know, the green area, and the further north you go, the more Labor it becomes in Labor versus Green terms. And, you know, simply what's happened to Wills is that it's going to chunk in the south, and that's very bad news for Labor in respect to that seat. And yes, it's going to be a very willing contest in Wills at the next election between Labor and the Greens.
And Samantha Ratnam, who has run for Wills before, but in the intervening time, she's been elected to the upper house and become the leader of the state Greens party. So probably a stronger candidate than she was last time she stood. And that's been a very contentious seat around Palestine protests. I saw a picture the other day of Peter Khalil's office covered in high security shutters. There's been a lot of protests, and the northern end of the electorate, which is much more multicultural, is always in the Labor heartland. There's a bit of a theory that the Greens might be able to peel away some votes there of people who are upset about Labor's position on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Well, yeah, even taking the more conventional view that I'd been doing of just planning the last results onto the next ones, every election brings up these sort of different flashpoint issues that sort of test Labor on the left flank. And there's a very ripe one here, as you've just mentioned. And even before the boundaries were out, you know, as you've said, Samantha Ratnam's targeting this seat, that was the theory. Even if Wills' boundaries hadn't changed, here was an opportunity for them to not just be the party of the inner city southern end of the electorate, to hit Labor at their multicultural flank further afield and in the more northern parts of Melbourne, where traditionally the Greens have had no purchase at all. The extent to which that changes, we'll see, but it was already a really interesting contest between Labor and the Greens, and now the balance has been tipped quite substantially in the Greens' favour.
Well, that, I mean, as a final point, is a good place to emphasise that when you and I and Anthony Green calculate margins, that's setting a new baseline, right? Like, it's not taking into account all the many factors that are going to influence the next election. New candidates, different campaign targeting choices from the parties, just overall vote trends one way or the other. Of course, those things are going to shift it, but doing these calculations kind of gives us a starting point, right? And you kind of need that before you can assess what changes.
And, you know, that's the case in Wills, and it's also the case in Bullwinkle, as I said before. We can use as a starting point that Labor would have won it if everyone voted as they did in 2022. But, you know, there in particular, I have a reason to think that won't be the case. You need to be judicious in interpreting these things for all of these local contingencies.
Final thing, the process from here. We have had the redistribution committee draft the boundaries. There's now an augmented redistribution commission that adds the chair of the commission, who's a former judge, and the Australian statistician to each state's commission. And then we're going to get, there's a current round of objections, and there'll be comments on those objections. There may even be public hearings. And then we will get a final decision probably around October, so that we'll be ready for an election in the next year. How much is it realistic to expect could change in these boundaries, or what is just too much to expect the committee to consider?
Perhaps, you know, a factor here is that, as you said, this has already taken a long time, and perhaps that reduces the possibility that they're going to reinvent the wheel when they revise it. There will be revisions. There always are, particularly in the bigger states, where there'll be a lot of, you know, there'll be submissions from the major parties that will undoubtedly be self-interested, but there'll also be a lot of people who will be raising legitimate issues that the commissioners would have missed and that they'll take on board, and I'm sure that there'll be a little bit of tweaking here and there. But I don't think that we're going to see anything fundamentally different. I think the basic architecture is going to be the same. The abolished electorates are going to be the abolished electorates. I read that the Liberal Party are going to object to the abolition of Higgins. They probably want Kooyong abolished instead. I don't know exactly what their thinking is.
It feels like something they've got to do for show.
Oh, no doubt. And, you know, I don't think they're going to have any luck. There'll be tweaks, there'll be revisions, but I think this does fundamentally set up the battleground on which the next election will be fought.
I think generally they're willing to consider changes, but I think generally you've got to make the budget add up when you propose changes. You know, you can't just say, don't abolish my seat, but you need to be able to say, what will you do instead without having to completely unpick the whole state? So in the Kingsford Smith case, being able to say, this is what you should do to the circle of Barton, Grandler and Sydney to make that work. So that's about it for this episode of the Tally Room podcast. Thank you, William, for joining me.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure.
You can find this podcast on your podcast app of choice. If you like the show, please consider rating or reviewing us on iTunes. You can follow the Tally Room on Mastodon at tallyroom@mastodon.au or like us on Facebook. This podcast is made possible thanks to the generous support of our donors on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/tallyroom. Ad-free versions of this podcast are now available for Patreon subscribers. Information about this podcast is available at tallyroom.com.au and you can email questions or feedback to thetallyroom@gmail.com. Thanks to Chris Dubrow for writing the music you hear in this episode. Once again, thanks for listening.